We all know our phones and laptops are incredibly powerful, right? But imagine a machine that's millions, even billions of times faster. It's almost hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, it really is.
Today, we're diving deep into exactly those machines, supercomputers.
Welcome to the Deep Dive, and our mission today is really to unpack what makes these giants tick. We'll look at how they evolved, which is a fascinating story in itself.
Absolutely.
We'll get into the unique challenges in, building and just running them, especially things like power and cooling.
Oh, yeah, the heat must be incredible.
It is. And we'll look at their applications. Some might surprise you, and then peek into what the future might hold for these titans.
And for this deep dive, we've drawn heavily on the extensive Wikipedia entry for supercomputer, among other sources. It really helps frame just how different these are. They're not just like scaled-up desktops.
Not at all. They represent a real pinnacle of engineering, a completely different way of tackling problems that are just, well, otherwise
A
unsolvable.
fundamental shift, you said. So let's start there. What actually makes a computer super? Because, like I said, it's easy to just picture a really, really big PC.
That's a fair starting point, but the key is this: a supercomputer has a high level of performance compared to a general purpose computer. And crucially, we don't measure that performance in MIPS or million instructions per second like you might for a regular CPU.
Okay, not MIPS. So what's the metric then?
It's FLOPS, floating point operations per second. That's the gold standard for scientific and engineering calculations, which is what these machines are mostly built for.
FLOPS. Got it. So scale-wise, how many FLOPS are we talking about? My desktop feels zippy, but I'm guessing it's not quite supercomputer level.
Probably not, unless you have something very special. Your desktop might hit, say, hundreds of gigaflops. That's 10 to the 11 veloPS, maybe up to tens of teraflops, which is 10 to the 13.
Okay, billions or trillions of calculations. Still sounds like a lot.
It is, but supercomputers. Well, since 2022, we've had exascale systems. These can perform over 10 to the 18 foAVLPS.
10 to the 18. What is that, a quintillion?
A quintillion calculations.
Yeah.
Every single second. It's a scale that's just frankly mind-boggling.
Wow. Okay, that puts it in perspective. A quintillion. And here's a fascinating fact that speaks volumes about software. Since November 2017, every single one of the world's top 500 fastest supercomputers runs on Linux.
Isn't that something? It really shows how the flexibility, the open source nature of Linux made it basically the only game in town for managing systems this complex and this customized. Proprietary systems just couldn't keep up.
Makes sense. And this power isn't just for show, right? Why do we need machines that can do a quintillion calculations a second?
Right, they're absolutely essential in computational science. Think about fields like quantum mechanics, incredibly complex weather forecasting, climate change research, oil and gas exploration.
Okay, so real-world modeling.
Exactly. Molecular modeling, too, figuring out the structure and properties of chemicals, complex proteins, new materials. And then there are the massive physical simulations.
Like what kind of simulations?
Things like simulating the very first moments after the Big Bang, or modeling the aerodynamics of a new jet or spacecraft, even simulating nuclear weapons detonation or nuclear fusion reaction.
Stuff you definitely can't do in a real lab easily.
Precisely. And historically, let's not forget cryptanalysis, breaking codes. Supercomputers have always been vital there.
Okay, so these are tools for tackling the absolute biggest scientific and security challenges. But they didn't just appear, right? This power evolved over time. Where did it all start?
It really kicked off in the 1960s. One of the very first was the UNIVAC LARS in 1960, built for the US Navy. Still used high-speed drum memory, which seems ancient now.
Drum memory, wow.
Then came the IBM 7030 stretch in 61 for Los Alamos. They wanted something 100 times faster than existing machines. It didn't quite hit that mark, but technologically, it was a huge leap.
What made it such a leap?
It pioneered transistors, a massive step beyond vacuum tubes, magnetic core memory, pipeline instructions, which is huge.
Pipelining.
Yeah.
That's where the processor starts the next instruction before the first one finishes, right? Kind of like an assembly line.
Exactly like an assembly line. It was revolutionary then, but it's fundamental to how all modern processors work. The stretch also had prefetched data and random access disk drives. It even formed the basis for the IBM 7950 Harvest, which was used for, you guessed it, cryptanalysis.
And meanwhile, over in the UK.
Right, at the University of Manchester, the Atlas computer was another early pioneer in the early 60s. It aimed for 1 million instructions per second.
A MIP back when that was the metric.
Right, and it introduced a huge memory space for the time, up to 1 million words, using virtual memory. It swapped data between faster magnetic core and slower drum storage. That's another concept we still use today.
And it did time sharing too.
Yes. Its operating system pioneered time sharing, letting more than one program run seemingly at the same time, a huge step for efficiency.
Okay, so the foundations were being laid. But then a particular name starts to dominate the story.
Seymour Cray, absolutely. Working at Control Data Corporation, or CDC, he designed the CDC 6600, which came out in 1964.
Yeah, this one was different.
Oh, yeah. It moved to silicon transistors, which were faster but hotter than the earlier germanium ones. And Cray's solution, refrigeration, like actual freon cooling built into the computer.
You're kidding. Refrigeration in a computer in the 60s.
I'm not kidding. It was necessary to handle the heat. And the result. The 6600 outperformed everything else by about 10 times. That's when the term supercomputer really stuck. They sold 100 of them at $8 million each.
$8 million in 1960s money. That's incredible.
It defined the market. Later, Cray left CDC, formed Cray Research, and in 1976 delivered the Cray 1, an 80 megahertz machine, iconic design. It became one of the most successful supercomputers in history.
I feel like I've seen pictures of that one, the C-shaped design.
That's the one. And then came the Cray 2 in 1985. 8 CPUs and even more advanced cooling, it used liquid immersion with a special inert fluid called fluorinert.
Dunked the whole thing in liquid.
Pretty much. A cooling waterfall, they called it. And the Cray 2 was the first machine to officially break the gigaflop barrier, over a billion floating point operations per second. 1.9 GFLOPS, to be exact.
So Cray was focused on making these incredibly fast, single, powerful vector processors. But another idea was emerging around the same time, right?
Yes, the massively parallel revolution. Instead of one or a few super fast processors, the idea was to use lots of simpler processors working together. The Ilya-Štojt in the 70s was really the first realized example of this.
How did that work out?
It had development problems. They planned for 256 processors, but only built 64. But even that partial success pointed the way to the future, showing the potential of parallelism.
Although Cray himself wasn't immediately sold, was he? That's where the famous quote comes in.
Exactly. He famously quipped, "If you were plowing a field, which would you rather use? Two strong oxen or 1,024 chickens?" A brilliant line.
It is good, but it turns out the chickens had potential.
They did. By the early 80s, MIT's connection machine, the CM1, used 65,536 simplified custom microprocessors, all working in parallel. And this trend really took off in the mid-90s.
Why then?
Because general-purpose CPU performance had improved so much. Suddenly, you didn't need incredibly expensive, custom-designed vector processors anymore. You could build a supercomputer using thousands of off-the-shelf processors, the same kind you might find in workstations or servers.
Ah, the commodity hardware approach.
Exactly. By the turn of the 21st century, designs featuring tens of thousands of commodity CPUs were the norm.
And this connects back to Linux, doesn't it?
It does. In 1998, David Bader built what's considered the first Linux supercomputer using commodity parts, an Alta cluster using 8 standard dual Intel Pentium to second processors.
Just 8. Seems small now.
It was just the beginning. This work led directly to Roadrunner in 1999, built using similar principles, which landed on the TOP500 list, one of the 100 fastest supercomputers in the world, available for open science. It proved the concept.
What a transition.
Mm-hmm.
From bespoke refrigerated giants to clusters of commodity PCs running Linux. And where does the global leadership sit today?
Well, the U.S. has long been a leader. Japan made huge strides in the 80s and 90s, and now China is increasingly active and a major player.
And the current fastest.
As of November 2024, that's El Capitan at Lawrence Livermore National Lab in the U.S. The U.S. has 5 of the top 10 currently. Italy has 2. Japan, Finland, and Switzerland have 1 each.
So it's a global effort. And didn't the whole list hit a milestone recently?
Yeah, a cool one. In June 2018, if you added up the power of all the machines on the TOP500 list, their combined performance broke the 1 exaflop/s mark for the first time.
The collective power is just immense. But all that power must generate an unbelievable amount of heat. You mentioned cooling before. That seems like a constant battle.
Oh, it's the battle in many ways. The management of heat density has remained a key issue for most centralized supercomputers. Basically, almost all the electricity going in comes out as heat.
And we're talking megawatts of power, right? Did you mention an example?
Yeah, the Tianhe 1A in China, it consumes 4.04 megawatts. Just the electricity bill, plus the energy needed for cooling, works out to something like $3.5 million per year. assuming, you know, standard electricity costs.
$3.5 million a year just to keep it running.
Yep. It's a massive operational cost. And it drives incredible innovation in cooling. We talked about Cray-2's FloorInert waterfall.
And IBM's approaches.
Right. IBM's BlueJean systems use low-power processors, partly to manage heat. Their Power 775 uses water cooling. And they even have the IBM Aquasar system, which uses hot water cooling.
Hot water? How does that work?
It's efficient at carrying heat away, apparently. And the really clever part is the heated water is then used to heat buildings. So they're recapturing some of that energy.
That's really smart engineering. Any other wild cooling methods?
Well, the Gyoku supercomputer in Japan uses both a massively parallel design and liquid immersion cooling, taking that Cray-2 idea even further.
So efficiency is key. How do they measure that?
The metric is FOPS per watt. How much computation do you get for each watt of power consumed? And there's been huge progress. Roadrunner in 2008 got about 376 megafLOPS per watt.
Okay.
By 2010, IBM's BlueJean Q hit 1,684 MFLOPSW. That's more than four times the efficiency in just 2 years.
So improvements are happening, but is there a fundamental limit here?
Very much so. The ability of the cooling systems to remove waste heat is a limiting factor. Future designs are increasingly seen as power limited. It's not just about making faster chips. It's about powering and cooling them sustainably.
Okay, so we've got these incredibly powerful, incredibly hot machines built from sometimes surprising parts. But hardware is only half the story.
Yeah.
What about the software? How do you actually run something like this?
That's another area that's seen a massive shift. Early on, operating systems were custom tailored, completely bespoke for each machine to squeeze out every bit of performance. But that's incredibly time consuming and expensive. So the big trend has been the adaptation of generic software such as Linux. As we said, most modern supercomputers use Linux-based operating systems.
But not just standard off-the-shelf Linux, right?
No. Typically, each manufacturer has its own specific Linux distribution, tweaked and optimized for their specific hardware, the interconnects, the nodes, everything.
And it can get even more complex than that.
Oh, yes. Modern systems often use different operating systems on different nodes. You might have a really small and efficient, lightweight kernel, like something called CNK or CNL, running on the thousands of compute nodes doing the actual calculations.
It's the bare minimum needed.
Exactly. But then on the server nodes or the I/O nodes that manage storage and access, you might have a larger system, such as a full Linux distribution.
Okay, so a complex software ecosystem.
Yeah.
And programming these things, I imagine it's not like writing an app for your phone.
Not quite. You absolutely need special programming techniques to exploit their speed. The key is parallelism, breaking the problem down so thousands of processors can work on it at once.
And how do programmers manage that?
They use specific APIs, application programming interfaces. The big ones are MPI, the message passing interface for communication between nodes, and OpenMP for parallelism within a single node.
MPI and OpenMP.
And if the supercomputer uses GPUs, those general purpose graphics processing units, then programmers will use tools like CJ from NVIDIA or the open standard OpenCL.
So specialized tools are essential. What's the biggest challenge for programmers?
A huge amount of effort goes into optimizing an algorithm for the interconnect characteristic of the machine. That means making sure the processors aren't just sitting idle, wasting time waiting on data from other nodes. Data movement is often the bottleneck.
Getting the data to the right place at the right time across thousands of processors.
Exactly. And debugging these massively parallel programs, as you can imagine, it's quite difficult. Finding a bug that only appears when 10,000 processors interact in a certain way. Yeah, it's tough.
I bet. Now, you mentioned earlier that supercomputing isn't just happening in these giant centralized facilities anymore. What about distributed approaches?
Right. There's grid computing, sometimes called opportunistic. This basically creates a super virtual computer by harnessing the idle time of many loosely coupled volunteer computing machines.
Ah, like folding at home, where people let their home PCs run simulations when they're not using them.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Folding at home is a prime example. Back in April 2020, they reported a staggering 2.5 exaflops of x86 processing power collectively.
2.5 exaflops.
Yeah.
From volunteer computers.
Yeah. Other big ones are BOINC, which hosts many different scientific projects, and GIMPS, the great internet mersenne prime search, hunting for huge prime numbers.
But these grid systems have limitations, right?
Mm-hmm. They do. Because the computers are loosely coupled and connecting over the regular internet, basic grid computing cannot handle traditional supercomputing tasks such as fluid dynamic simulations that need really fast, low latency communication between nodes.
So good for some tasks, not all. Are there variations?
Yes. There are quasi-opportunistic approaches that try to get higher quality of service by having a bit more control over the assignment of tasks and maybe using more dedicated network links than just pure volunteer systems.
And then there's the cloud. Can you just rent supercomputing time now?
Pretty much. That's the idea behind high-performance computing clouds, or HPC clouds. It's HPC as a service.
What are the supposed advantages there?
Well, the promise is scalability, resources being on-demand, fast, and inexpensive. You only pay for what you use when you need it.
Sounds good. Are there downsides?
There are definitely challenges. Running HPC workloads inside virtual machines can add virtualization overhead. Sharing resources with other tenants, multi-tenancy, can sometimes impact performance unpredictably. And network latency issues can still be a problem if your virtual compute nodes are physically far apart in the data center.
So some companies are wary.
Yes. Penguin Computing, for instance, runs a cloud called POD, Penguin On Demand. They use a bare metal compute model, no virtualization, arguing it hurts HPC performance. They specifically point out that latency between nodes allocated far apart in a typical cloud can really impair performance for tightly coupled simulations.
Right. So the cloud offers convenience, but maybe not always peak performance for the most demanding tasks. Okay, we've covered hardware, software, cooling. Mm-hmm. How do we actually measure which machine is best? And what's next?
Well, first, there's a useful distinction between capability computing and capacity computing.
Capability versus capacity. What's the difference?
Capability computing is about using the maximum computing power to solve a single large problem in the shortest amount of time. Think of a problem so big only the world's biggest machine can tackle it, like a very complex weather simulation.
Okay, pushing the absolute limit for one giant task.
Exactly. Capacity computing, on the other hand, is more about efficient, cost-effective computing power to solve a few somewhat large problems or many small problems. It's about throughput for more routine, though still demanding tasks. Supercomputers are primarily built for capability.
The Formula One car analogy you used earlier.
Right. And the main way we rank these capability machines is the TOP 500 list. It's been ranking the world's fastest publicly known supercomputers since 1993.
And that's based on a specific benchmark.
Yes, the LINPACK benchmark results. It basically measures how fast a computer can solve a dense system of linear equations, which involves a lot of floating point math. It typically performs LU decomposition of a large matrix.
And they report two numbers, right? Rmax and Rpeak?
Correct. Rpeak is the theoretical peak performance, what the machine could do if everything ran perfectly. Rmax is the actual measured performance achieved on the LINPACK benchmark. Rmax is the number used for the ranking.
Okay. And the current number one, again, is?
El Capitan at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. As of November 2024, its Rmax was $1,742.00000. So that's 1.74 exaflop PS. And it has over 11 million total cores.
11 million cores. Just incredible. And who's building the most machines on the list these days?
Interestingly, back in 2018, Lenovo became the world's largest provider for the Tidy 500 supercomputers, producing 117 of the systems on that list. It shows how the market has broadened.
So looking ahead, exascale is here. What's the next frontier?
Well, the global race to create robust and widely usable exascale systems is still very much ongoing between China, the US, the EU, Japan, and others. But people are already looking beyond exaflop.
Beyond a quintillion calculations per second. What's next?
Zettaflop PS. That's 10 to the power of 21 Fflop PS, 1,000 times more than exascale.
Zettaflop PS, what would we even do with that kind of power?
Well, one researcher, Eric De Benedictis, theorizes that Zettaflop PS is what you'd need for full weather modeling that could accurately predict weather over a two-week time span.
Okay, truly reliable long-range forecasts. That would be game-changing.
Yeah.
When might we see Zettaflop PS systems?
His estimate was around 2030, though that seems ambitious, maybe. We'll see. There's also talk about future microprocessors moving into the third dimension, stacking layers for specialized tasks like complex Monte Carlo simulations.
3D chips. Cool. But what about those practical issues, cost and sustainability, if exascale machines cost millions just to power?
That's the elephant in the room. The increasing cost of operating these machines is huge, driven mainly due to increasing power consumption. A top machine in the mid-90s might have used 100 kilowatts. By 2010, it was 1 to 2 megawatts. Exascale systems use tens of megawatts.
Tens of megawatts?
Yes. DARPA identified power consumption as perhaps the most pervasive challenge in achieving exascale computing. It's why we now have the Green 500 list, ranking machines by energy efficiency, FLOPS per watt, not just raw speed.
So driving efficiency is critical. Are there other approaches?
We're seeing more bundling of resources through a distributed supercomputer infrastructure, like the PRACE initiative in Europe, which pools HPC resources across multiple countries, making access more available and maybe more efficient overall.
And you mentioned Iceland earlier.
Right. A fantastic example of tackling sustainability head on. They built the world's first zero-emission supercomputer at the Thor data center. It runs entirely on completely renewable sources, geothermal and hydropower.
And Iceland's cool climate helps with the cooling bill, I assume.
Exactly. Free air cooling for a good chunk of the year. It shows what's possible.
But funding these multi-million, sometimes billion-dollar machines must still be a challenge.
Immense. Costs have skyrocketed. A top system might have been 10 million euros in the mid-90s. By 2010, it was 40, 50 million euros or more. This leads to different funding models, like the UK having national HPC facilities, while Germany uses a mixed model involving federal and state governments plus research institutions.
It really takes a concerted effort. You know, it's fascinating how these real-world machines have also captured our imagination in fiction.
Oh, absolutely. They often represent the pinnacle of intelligence, or sometimes something to be feared. You've got icons like HA 9000 from 2001.
And BWOPR from War Games.
Yeah.
Learning about thermonuclear war.
Or Asimov's Multivac, Ellison's terrifying AM, Douglas Adams' deep thought, calculating the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
Took us 7.5 million years, though.
A very patient supercomputer, and even the thinking machine supercomputer in Jurassic Park, used for sequencing the dinosaur DNA.
Right. They pop up everywhere. It shows how central massive computation has become to our idea of the future.
It really does. They embody that cutting edge and possibility.
Well, this has been quite a journey. From vacuum tubes and refrigerated rooms in the 60s, through the Cray era, the parallel revolution with its chickens.
Ah, yes.
To today's exascale behemoths running Linux, grappling with petafloppy S, megawatts, and incredibly complex software. It's clear these aren't just fast number crunchers.
Not at all. They're fundamental tools driving science, engineering, medicine, security, enabling discoveries and solutions that would be simply impossible otherwise. From mapping the universe to forecasting hurricanes to designing vaccines.
Truly shaping our world. So let's leave our listeners with this. We talked about zettafloppy S maybe being achievable around 2030. Mm. We've already seen simulations of a rat's brain.
Incredible fidelity in those simulations, yeah.
As these machines continue their relentless march towards ever greater power, what currently impossible problems might suddenly become solvable? How could that change your understanding of, well, everything? What problem out there do you wish a supercomputer could finally crack? Something to think about.